I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The primary in the Kansas City, Missouri mayor's race is just weeks away, and 11 candidates are competing to make it to the next round. Today, our political panel analyzes the campaigns to see if anyone stands out from the pack. They'll look at Kansas Governor Kelly's ongoing tussle with the legislature, and with Mike Pompeo out, suggest who to look for in the race to replace Senator Pat Roberts. Then we remember Jackie Robinson. He changed the course of American history for black athletes. His biographer will talk about Robinson's legacy and what the man faced as the first black in baseball's major leagues. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Is the crowded Kansas City race for mayor starting to become a two-candidate battle? Just maybe. A new poll out shows that Jolie Justice and Steve Miller moving out front here. Meantime, in Kansas, Governor Laura Kelly continues to battle Republican leaders who are messing up the new governor's plans. In Missouri, lawmakers are taking steps to make it seem that the Clean Missouri Good Government Initiative, which voters approved with overwhelming support last November, never happened. There's a lot going on, including a very crowded race for the Democratic presidential nomination. And here to help us digest all this are our political pundits. They are former Missouri State Representative Kevin Corlew, a Kansas City Republican, is about to try his hand at punditry. Kevin, great to have you here and good luck.
Thank you, Steve. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Caroline Sweeney is a reporter with KCTV5. Caroline, good to have you.
Hi. Thanks, Steve.
Dave Helling is my longtime colleague on the editorial board of the Kansas City Star. David, good morning.
Great to be here.
Well, let's dive right in here to this packed race for Kansas City mayor. A new independent poll from Remington Research, which is connected to Jeff Rowe's Axiom Strategies political firm here in town, has Jolie Justice and Steve Miller breaking out of the pack. Justice is at 18%, Miller at 15%, but nearly 30% are undecided. No one else is closer than 7%. Kevin Corlew, what do you make of it? Is this a moment in this race that we're seeing some separation here, or does it not really mean all that much?
I do think you're seeing a little bit of separation and somewhat of what was expected, in my view, and that is you'd have a city council candidate, one of the members of the city council, kind of break out, but also somebody that's not on the city council that can have some separation. In this case, you see Jolie Justice, who has a lot of name recognition, both from her time on the council, but also as a state senator. And then you have local attorney Steve Miller, who's gained a lot of credibility through the years in the business community.
You know, David, it strikes me that this is traditional in some ways to have a sitting council member, as Kevin just pointed out, and somebody from the outside.
Right, although in Kansas City history, you typically also have an African-American candidate in the final and then someone who isn't an African-American. And so I think we're still, you know, the key number in that poll, Steve, is 30% undecided.
Right.
I mean, we're 5 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, out.
Right.
And a third of the electorate is still making up its mind. And my guess is most of those people don't even know what their choices are. So there is still great opportunity for one of the other candidates to step forward. Now, Kevin talked about Jolie Justice, the councilwoman, and I do think that she is one of the favorites to make the final field, in part because she's well-known, checks a lot of boxes, a member of the council, former state legislator,
right.
Well-known in the 4th District, the corridor, the so-called corridor. So I think she might be one of the favorites if we looked at it today. But the second-place finisher, or the other finalist, remains very much, in my mind, undetermined
at
this point.
Caroline, we're 5 weeks out here, and it strikes me that this race has been pretty low-key. Are you surprised by that, given the fact that there are 11 candidates in this field?
it's surprising that we're not seeing one person start to pull forward and step up with some more want to be on radio or television or newspaper or social media, things like that, to try and get their name out ahead of the pack. But one thing I think is really interesting about this Remington Research poll is that the error on that poll is 4%. So even though Jolie Justice might be polling at 18% and Steve Miller is polling at 15%, statistically, that's a tie. So not only are we seeing kind of the two top people right now statistically sitting at a tie, that's not going to pull us kind of out of, give us any more direction as to who we need to look for. But because we haven't seen anyone kind of step forward just yet, I think within the next 3 weeks, someone start to step up. And I think that's where we need to start looking at who's got money in the bank.
I was going to say, Kevin, you know, the candidates who are trailing here are going to have to find some way to get back in this race somehow. What might that look like?
Well, name ID is huge in an election like this, and even sitting city council members do not have that great of a name ID. So resources are necessary, and so that's where you look to kind of the secondary campaign, and that is the fundraising area, and you see who has the resources that in the last month they can put up on the airwaves, their ads, they can send out the mailers. That's going to make a critical difference because the voters are faced with a lot of people who may be unknown to them, even though they may be known in many circles and political circles, to the general population, a lot of them need to bump their ID. And so resources, as Caroline mentioned, is going to be a key.
Hey, you know, David, are there key differences here on some of these big issues? Because if there are, I'm not hearing them.
Well, and I think that's because it's common, Steve, in multi-candidate primaries, which we have here, in which, by the way, the candidates kind of generally agree on virtually all of the issues. There may be some gradations, but basically it's not a Republican versus Democratic thing. That the candidates, looking at the potential vote turnout in April, become very risk averse. I mean, you may need 7,000 votes to be one of the finalists, 8,000 votes. That's nothing. And so I'm sure that one of the thought processes these folks are going through is don't say anything to upset the apple cart this close to election day. And so what you get is a sameness. You get the candidates sort of agreeing on issues. They're all doing forums, by the way, and going door to door. It isn't as if they're not doing anything at all. But because they're risk averse and because we live in a late deciding political society, all of that sort of pushes you into kind of the quiet election that we're seeing now.
Yeah.
I've written, and I believe that the first candidate who sort of throws caution to the wind and says something, relatively aggressive and newsworthy about any issue would have an advantage because that person, that candidate would stick out in a race in which a third of the electorate still doesn't know what it wants to do.
You know, we also, to Dave's point here, Caroline, there is this feeling, maybe if you look back at the last big race we had for mayor, we had Sly James against Mike Burke, a race that was notably positive, above board, both candidates very intentionally not going negative, as we see in so many campaigns these days. You get a sense that if someone does go negative and takes on one of the front runners, that there might be a corresponding penalty for going negative that might turn off a whole lot of people out there.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see the same kind of vitriol that we see in, for example, Senate races or presidential elections, where you go and listen to these ads just constantly attacking the other candidates. But I think what you're going to see are small gestures on big issues. So candidates who have problems with the way the airport process may have been handled so far, that's where they're going to start maybe not pointing directly to people, but start putting their opinions in. And it could look as a slight to other candidates who may think differently than they do.
So if there aren't issue differences, there aren't the opportunity to go negative here, you sort of wind up, how are voters going to make up their minds, Kevin, as they look at this whole thing?
Well, I think a lot will come back to name identification for better or worse, and that people will not know the differences unless the candidates really do get out there and set some separation, which they seem to have not been willing to do up to this point.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, so you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with our political pundits this morning. Let's move to Kansas, Dave Helling. The new governor there, Laura Kelly, is trying to move forward with an agenda that includes adding $100 million or so to school funding to satisfy the state Supreme Court. She wants to find a way to protect vulnerable kids and expand Medicaid. But so far, she's not getting her way on much of anything. Republicans are spending money to make up for pension shortfalls. They're passing a tax cut. No movement on schools. How do you explain this?
Well, fairly easily. I spoke to someone who's connected to the legislative process in Kansas last week who told me that the Republicans have decided not to give Laura Kelly anything at all. Not school financing, not Medicaid expansion. I do think the tax cut is problematic. We'll come back to that in a minute. But they're not going to give in on the budget. I mean, the entire approach is we control both houses and the legislative branch. And as long as we stick together, we don't have to give her anything. Now, she does have the ability to veto legislation, and there are not the votes to override a veto, particularly of the tax cut, which you mentioned here a few minutes ago. So that's sort of a recipe for stalemate, which is not unfamiliar in Kansas. Remember when Kathleen Sebelius was governor?
I was going to say, this is very reminiscent.
Very similar situation. When she first came in, she wanted to raise sales taxes for schools, and the Republican legislature just basically ignored her. I am a bit surprised that there aren't more public discussions of the school financing issue, Steve, because that seems so easily fixed, particularly when the court is looking over everyone's shoulder. And we have an opportunity, it appears, to get the courts out of the schools in Kansas. You would think there would be more impetus to fix that. But based on all the conversations I've had as we hit roughly the halfway point, the Republican majority has just said, you're not getting anything from us, and that's where we stand.
Kevin Corlew, you used to be in the Republican majority in a different state on the Missouri side of the state line. Would Republicans really do something like that, just sort of agree that we're not going to give this new Democratic governor anything here?
There are some legislators that are really, you know, driven by political motives and politics as usual. But that's unfortunate, and that does happen, as you say. But oftentimes you would think that a time like this would be a time when both sides could come together and say, hey, we're not going to get our very partisan things done this time, but are there some things that we could work on, infrastructure or something that doesn't have the political bent to it?
Right.
Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, absolutely. You get a sense they're really testing her, Caroline. This is going to be a tough session for Laura Kelly.
Yeah, you have to remember that this was not the Republicans' candidate by any means, even though she touts bipartisanship, and that was throughout her gubernatorial nomination process. She talked about bipartisanship. She talked about common sense, you know, legislation and moving Kansas forward. But when you look at what the Republicans are wanting to get done, it's the polar opposite of what she was hoping to get done. And I think this is going to be the way it is, at least for this session. I don't know if public backlash after the session is over, when we've seen stalemate after stalemate and stall after stall, is going to warm some of those Republicans to maybe reaching across the aisle. But you also have to remember the moderate Republican coalition that was more or less likely to do the reaching in both the House and the Senate has they've lost some of those moderates to the Democratic Party, and that could be sending Republicans even farther into their corner.
I just think briefly, I do think if the Supreme Court in Kansas once again injects itself into the school financing picture and in essence finds the state liable again, enters court orders, threatens to shut down the schools, all of the mess that we've seen over the last couple of years. If they do that again this year, then I do think the backlash against Republicans will be profound and may convince them at a later date to sort of meet halfway with the governor on school finance. It's so easily solved, relatively easily solved, Steve. Plus, The idea of getting the courts out of the schools has an appeal to both parties. You know, I mean, so everybody wants the court out of the
It's just so interesting to me on pensions. You know, the legislature is doing almost the opposite of what Governor Kelly initially proposed. She wanted to sort of extend the debt over
a number of years, refinance it
so she had more money to play with this year. But instead, the legislature just passed a bill that says, hey, we're going to pay off some past debt and eat up some of the available cash they have on hand.
And they didn't do that because they wanted to pay off the debt to Capers. They wanted to embarrass the governor. The whole point of that bill is to make her sign or veto a bill that, in essence, helps retirees, or at least the fund for retirees, and cut down the amount of money available for other things in the state of Kansas. So there's so much politics going on now. And my guess is that continues until the end of the session, except on school finance, where I do think there is a goal that both parties can agree to.
Let's flip over to Missouri. You know, voters approved the Clean Missouri initiative by big margins last November. Now Republicans are trying to undo some of those provisions that have to do with how the state redraws legislative districts and provides the public with access to legislative mail and records. Kevin Corlew, again, you just worked over there in the General Assembly. What's fueling this backlash against Clean Missouri?
Well, I think there was a sense that a number of the provisions in Clean Missouri have some constitutional issues and some problems that will be worked out in the courts, in my estimation.
But it passed with more than 60% support.
It did. It did. And it goes to what you see with ballot petitions, for better or worse. You're faced with, you know, a few sentences of what may have a stack of pages behind it. And so I think that a number of things will get worked out in the courts, but I do think that you see the legislature trying to get ahead of some of that and maybe doing some legislative fixes on their own, which may be problematic as well from the standpoint of court battles going that way. But I think that
One legislative fix they're looking at is saying, hey, Clean Missouri called for more transparency and access to public records involving state lawmakers, even, you know, mail and that kind of thing. And the legislature is looking at that saying, we're going to go away from that entirely and shut down access and make the place less transparent than ever before, perhaps, if that bill passes.
Perhaps. And I think you have to look at this maybe in a broader scope. Some of those provisions that they're talking about, in my estimation, are already part of the law, and that you wouldn't have to disclose personal information, personally identification of people. And so there's some thought that I think they're trying to codify that and make sure that it's part of Clean Missouri as it is part of the open records law now. There are other provisions such as the deliberative process provision, which says that until a government makes a final decision, some of their deliberative communications don't have to be disclosed. So again, some of this, I think you see the legislature maybe perhaps trying to codify into clean law, which is already a part of the case law. Now, whether they're doing a good enough job of that or actually selling what they're doing is maybe another thing, because there's another camp that sees this as just trying to override the will of the people.
Right. Carolina, are Republicans going to succeed here?
You know, they could, especially when you're talking about where the majority sits in both the House and the Senate over in Jeff City. But something that I wanted to just tack on to Kevin's points were, I was speaking with a source that I have in the Missouri legislature, and he says this part of Clean Missouri, the Sunshine Law issue, is extremely divided down partisan lines. Hmm. The Democrats believe that the legislative branch of the state already falls underneath the Sunshine Laws, and that the third part of this amendment that kind of has everyone up in arms was, you know, that's what threw everyone over the edge. But when you look at the Republicans, there's discussion that the Republicans believe that the legislative branch does not fall underneath the Sunshine Law. So that's where you're going to see this push. And when you hold the majority in the legislature and your majority party is saying, but we don't fall under these, so we need to put up our barriers and we need to figure out, you know, what's not going to fly here in the future, that's where I think Republicans are going to succeed. I've also been speaking with another source who tells me that unlike when Governor Greitens was leading the state, and there was some tension over on the Senate side with how he interacted with the senators. There's more tension now in the House with how Republican leaders are dealing with Democrat wants. He said several times to me that when there are bills or initiatives or even discussions coming up, that partisan tension is starting to put the cold shoulder toward the Democrats. So I think kind of the partisanship and the politicking that might not play out in the public eye, that's where you're going to see the Republicans succeed, is this kind of backdoor, very in-depth inside baseball. That's where we're going to see it happen.
You know, I don't get a sense, David, bottom line, that this session of the General Assembly is going to change life as we know it on the planet. Is that a fair statement?
No, I think it's a status quo legislature. I think the governor is still trying to do something on infrastructure, and he might get something done before the end of the session. But I do want to talk a little bit about initiative and referendum, which is part of the Missouri Constitution. There's a story in Huffington Post today about how Republican legislative majorities in many states are overturning the will of the voters. They did it in Utah on Medicaid expansion, Wisconsin. Missouri is another example.
That's interesting.
Initiative was put into constitutions 120 years ago, basically as a populist reform to the perceived excesses of the Gilded Age. And the whole point of it was we can go around the legislature and do things that lawmakers don't want to do. That's why you have it. That's why you have it in Kansas City, by the way. But to the extent that legislators are increasingly trying to overturn the will expressed by voters at the polls, there's a collision coming. And I think voters at some point are going to say, wait a minute, we voted on things like Clean Missouri and minimum wage and other issues in the state, right to work. When our voice is heard, that's the end of it. And to the extent that legislators don't see it that way, I think there's a bit of a collision coming.
You know, two final points before we say goodbye here. In Kansas right now, the Secretary of State of the United States of America has definitively ruled himself out of next year's U.S. Senate race to replace Pat Roberts, who's retiring. Do you buy that? Is he out for good, Caroline, or are you not so sure?
I don't know. If I were Secretary of State, I think that's a pretty sweet place to be, honestly.
Yeah.
The Senate race is already so crowded. I don't know if I were Mike Pompeo, I'd want to get down in the mud and try and fight for this Senate seat at this moment.
What do you think, David?
My own view is that he's more definitive about not running in 2020 than a lot of people think. I think he said, I've ruled it out. I sort of take him at his word. But watch 2022. Because that's when Jerry Moran would be up. There are hints, whispers that he's not interested in running for re-election, in part because the Senate is such a disaster these days. If he doesn't run in 2022, Mike Pompeo could easily serve as Secretary of State until 2020. If Donald Trump loses, he's free to run in 2022.
Yeah.
If Donald Trump wins, he's free to be Secretary of State. I think what you're really seeing from Mike Pompeo is keeping his options open going forward. He has a long political career ahead of him, and 2020 is just one part of that timeline.
You know, this one final point, the Democratic presidential race is starting to move a little bit. Kevin Corlew, you're a Republican, but which of the candidates on the Democratic side have caught your attention who might be interesting to you?
Well, I think it's very early, obviously, in the race, and there are quite a few in the field, reminiscent about what the Republicans had last time around.
Yes.
But I think that you see Bernie Sanders with him, with his entering the race, he has the apparatus and the fundraising already in place. So I think you'll see him make a jump, and already in some polls, I think you've seen that in New Hampshire.
Could he beat Donald Trump?
Well, I think what may be problematic from his standpoint, I think that if the Democrats offered to the American people someone who was nicer than Trump, obviously, and someone who might come to the middle on issues, you might see that. But what you see in the Democrat Party, in my view, a lot of times happening now is that you have a lot of versions of the same message. a lot of the younger people entering in the race are very compelling from their stories and from their biographies, but they're saying the same type of messages. And if you see them keep, if you see the primary in such a way that it moves them very far progressive and to right. the left, that might be more problematic to them.
I just quickly disagree a little bit with Kevin on the, in this way. I think 2020 is a referendum on Donald Trump. Full stop. I mean, do you want him or do you not want him for another 4 years?
Yeah.
The Democrats are going to argue with each other a lot because they like to argue and because there is pressure to the left or from the left, particularly among younger voters.
But your point is it doesn't really matter who they
put. But they're going to nominate somebody, and then the country is going to decide whether they want another 4 years of Donald Trump, basically, because Democrats are not going to say, well, I really wanted Bernie, but it's, you know, Kamala Harris, and so I can't.
Who are you watching? Who's...
Well, I like her. I think she's you know, sort of this moderate approach that Kevin talked about. Young, you know, just I think a good candidate so far, Cory Booker. I do think the Democrats want to nominate a woman. They want to elect a woman as president of the United States, and so I think she might have a leg up in that regard. Elizabeth Warren, maybe. I will say I don't think Bernie will be the nominee. First of all, he's not a Democrat, so that's a start. And then I just don't think he'll be the nominee.
Caroline, who are you watching?
Well, if you've been a longtime follower of Cory Booker, this is the moment you've been waiting for. You know, watching him come from New Jersey and then get elected into the Senate. This is that moment that you've been kind of hoping for a young male Democrat to kind of step forward. I am interested to see how the women handle this race. We have, you know, more women running as Democrats than we did in 2016. So that's going to definitely change the tenor of the race and the way that we in the media talk about the race as well. So I'm keeping my eye on Cory Booker right now, though.
Okay, we'll leave it right there. That was the voice of Caroline Sweeney from KCTV5. Kevin Corlew, former state rep from the Kansas City area, was also here. Kevin, thanks for coming in. Good
Thank
to have you.
You.
And Dave Helling from the editorial board of the Kansas City Star.
Yep.
David, thanks
Good
very
to be
much.
Here.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the life and times of Jackie Robinson. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the program, we discussed the U.S. Supreme Court's decision that's putting states on notice about property seizures in criminal cases. You can hear that at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we meet the Kansas City mayoral candidate, Alicia Kennedy. We'll ask the councilwoman about her plans to move the city forward if elected. Join us for that conversation Tuesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Jackie Robinson once said, "I never cared about acceptance as much as I cared about respect." As the first African-American to play Major League ball, Robinson had plenty of opportunities to live that line. Jackie Robinson would have turned 100 this year, and tonight his biographer is in town to talk about the ways in which Robinson's story is a truly American story, one that reflects both the highs and lows and tragedies and triumphs of U.S. history and culture. Arnold Rampersad is the author of Jackie Robinson, A Biography. He's the Sarah Hart Kimball Professor in the Humanities Emeritus at Stanford University. He's speaking as part of Park University's 18th annual Spencer Cave Black History Month lecture. Professor Rampersad's other books include Days of Grace, a memoir co-authored by late tennis star and activist Arthur Ashe, and books on Ralph Ellison and Langston Hughes. He's a winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. In 2011, President Obama awarded him the National Humanities Medal. Professor, what an honor to have you here. Thanks for taking some time.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, you can't help but wonder what Jackie Robinson would think about our world today with its Colin Kaepernick's and police shootings of black men and cities like Kansas City that remain so segregated. He died back in 1972. What do you think he'd think today?
Well, we know what he thought then about civil rights and the struggle for civil rights, and he was determined to be as much on the front lines as he could be, and certainly he was a major supporter of Martin Luther King Jr. And, of course, he also had his allegiances to people like Nelson Rockefeller and others. So he was pushing on all fronts, but he was he saw the importance of protesting against injustice, pushing for the civil rights, for justice for everyone, definitely.
He was a Republican.
He was a Republican, yes.
Which might surprise some people.
Yes, yes, yes. He was a Republican. He supported Nixon against Kennedy in 1960 because Nixon, hands down, had the better civil rights record. I mean, that's one reason he...
But he came to applaud John Kennedy on his civil rights record as time went on.
Yes, he did. And Kennedy graciously praised Robinson openly. But his main tie was to Nelson Rockefeller, who represented a brand of Republicanism that is not extinct today, but is definitely in the minority.
Moderation, right?
Moderation,
yeah.
Right.
You know, there's been concerns expressed about the whitewashing of prominent figures like Martin Luther King Jr., who was not a popular man shortly before he died. To what extent is that a concern with Jackie Robinson?
Well, I don't know if he has been whitewashed in any way. He had some difficulty even from childhood. Certainly his young manhood was troubled. I mean, he was always standing up against authority. But even outside that area of if you want, civil rights, he wasn't a loner by any means, but he was thinking all the time. I believe that is really the key. He was thinking all the time. He was aware of himself as an athlete, but also aware of the limitations that society placed on him and people like him. And he was always standing up. In fact, all of the incidents that marked, or from some people's point of view, marred his young manhood had to do with standing up to authority, including police authority.
Hmm. You know, the Robinson family came to you to write this book. Why did they pick you, do you think?
Well, I think Mrs. Robinson picked me. She said that she, just the same way that Arthur Ashe asked me to write what was to be his last book.
You don't pick your books. Others pick them for you.
Well, if I pick the books, I make mistakes. If others pick you, you're on firmer ground to begin with. But, I mean, I think that she obviously respected what I had done with people like W.B. Du Bois.
Yes.
And with Langston Hughes. But in particular, I think, I mean, she wanted a book that was to be about, quote-unquote, more than baseball. There were many, many books on Jackie Robinson, but virtually all of them focus on his baseball. And I was determined to go from the beginning to the end, from his birth in Georgia under very difficult circumstances, growing up in Pasadena, trace the entire life, try to draw an accurate composite portrait of a complex human being.
You know, you were given access to his papers, which others hadn't had before. What did you learn about him that surprised you?
What did I learn about Robinson? Certainly the papers, you know, the private papers, the letters to his wife, for example, letters to Branch Rickey. They revealed a human being who was, quote-unquote, again, much more than a baseball player, who had limitations in terms of education. He almost graduated from UCLA, but no one would say he was a deep reader. But he was always, I think, a deep and complex thinker, and in particular thinking about the American history as represented, say, by his mother and her mother. So he was always aware of this, of this sort of history that stood in contrast to the kind of laurels heaped on him because of his extraordinary athletic prowess in four areas, four sports.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the life and times of Jackie Robinson with his biographer, Arnold Rampersad. He'll be speaking tonight about Jackie Robinson. It'll be at 7 this evening at the Gem Theater in the 18th and Vine Jazz District. It's part of Park University's Spencer Cave Black History Month lecture series. Admission is free to the lecture, but to ensure seating, registration is required at park.edu/Spencer Cave. We'll put that email address out in a little bit as well. You know, Jackie Robinson came to Major League Baseball from the Negro Leagues, and specifically the Kansas City Monarchs, you know, obviously based here in town. But he ultimately became frustrated with the experience of the Black Negro Leagues experience. Why?
Well, I think many of the players of that time were frustrated. One major source of source of frustration was that they could not move on to the major leagues, but had to put up with conditions, playing conditions, paying conditions, the quality of their salaries that you know, that left them, many of them, aggrieved, and he was one of those. Although he was not in the Negro Leagues very long. He was there 1 year. And when Branch Rickey, the
owner of the Dodgers,
of the Dodgers, reached out and plucked him, it's hard to understand why Rickey chose him, because he was not a superstar in the Negro Leagues. He had, baseball was one of his four major sports, but it was a sport in which he performed most poorly at UCLA. Hmm. I think at one point, 0-49, I think, was his batting
record.
But Rickey somehow decided this was the person.
What do we know about why Rickey picked him?
I think Rickey picked him because Robinson, well, for various reasons. Robinson had a military background. I think that appealed to Rickey. He was a devout Methodist, as was Rickey. He had stood up to authority, and oddly enough, although you would think that Rickey would go in the absolute opposite direction, he liked that about Robinson. He did insist that for 3 years Robinson not speak out, strike back metaphorically, but he liked the fighting spirit, and so it's a bit of a mystery, but Rickey knew what he wanted, and I think what he wanted ultimately was to sort of intervene in American history, racial, moral history.
He understood this person would be obviously someone of
absolutely
great consequence. Yeah,
absolutely. And he was, and the person had to succeed. Really, if Robinson failed, it was thought by many people, and a lot of people predicted that he would fail. It would set back the cause of integration in baseball, but also integration in the society for a long time to come.
Now, what does it say about Jackie Robinson, Professor, that not only did he succeed, but he did so with as much pressure that was on him as there was? He became the MVP of the National Baseball League within a couple of years.
Yes, well, it says that he was a fighter, that he had a powerful will, but he also was magnificently gifted as an athlete. He was a bona fide superstar as a football player, which was probably his number one sport, and as a basketball player in the Pacific League, and took in places like Stanford and USC and so on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when presented with the challenge of mastering baseball and mastering a particular position in the infield that he hadn't really played before, he just rose to the challenge. He had the gift. He had an inner confidence that came out most spectacularly, I think, in his ability to steal home, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, the most audacious
move. Play. And he did it. He did it a bunch of times.
He did it about 19 times, I think, which is very unusual today. Not many people try it.
You know, he was called up just shortly before opening day that first year, 1947. Okay. What was that first day like for him?
Well, there were two first days, in a way. The first day when, the year before, the Dodger organization brought him in as a Montreal Royal, and he played in Newark, and that was like the beginning of his move into Major League Baseball, because he was now playing as a, basically as a Dodger. And it was, I mean, a lot of people expected him to fail. A lot of people hoped he would succeed. But in that first game in 1946, the year before he became a Dodger, in that first game he hit a home run. He stole bases. He just behaved with a kind of controlled abandon that would become his hallmark in Major League Baseball. He was always challenging, you know, the fielders, challenging the catchers, and so on, and doing whatever it took to win. And and he was also able to bond with his teammates, and by and large, they, you know, respected him. And someone like P.B. Reese, in particular, who was a white Southerner. They played together magnificently, fraternally, as it were, and with each success, Ricky's grand experiment became more and more reality.
I was going to say, how was he accepted at first? What do we know about that, and in terms of the fans as well as the opposing players?
Well, we know for a fact that many of the Dodgers did not want him to be signed. They did not. Reese did not object, and which is very interesting, because Reese was a star. He was, as I said before, a white Southerner, and also Robinson would be competing for his spot. Reese was in the Army, but Reese just, you know, said, "Let the best man, let the better man win," and they became good friends, and that facilitated a lot of Jackie's later success and his acceptance. No, there was a rebellion in the Dodger team. There were people who signed a petition, and Ricky basically said, "You play with him or you leave." He was very tough in that way.
And Leo Durocher, the manager at the time, put his foot down too.
Particularly, absolutely, he was the enforcer. I mean, in his style, and you know, and he just flatly said that, you know, here he is. Yeah, he's going to help us win ball games, and that is all that matters.
But other players were pretty rough on him. There were gashes to Jackie Robinson's right. legs from people sliding in pretty hard. They let him know. Some let him know he was not welcome.
Some let him know. Yes, especially when he went to Philadelphia, and that turned out to be, in some respects, the worst experience that he had. The manager, the hotels would not allow the Dodgers to stay in the place where they had stayed for years.
In Philadelphia,
they said, "No, can't stay here. You either not bring him into the hotel or you move to another hotel." So they had to move. They moved to another hotel. That was the level of opposition to him. But gradually people came around, and as you said, within a couple of years, he was MVP of the National League and, in effect, MVP of Major League Baseball.
Who was the player who slid in too hard and gashed his leg?
Is that Slaughter?
Might have been Eno Slaughter, yeah. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. People always pointed out that Eno Slaughter would have run over his grandmother if she was in the garden.
Not necessarily a racial thing then, eh?
Well, yes, not necessarily.
How lonely were those first few months for Jackie Robinson?
Extremely lonely, except that he had the support of his wife.
His new wife at the time.
New wife at the time, Rachel Robinson, who had been at UCLA with him, who came from what we would call a classy background, a cultivated background, attending the symphony, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, but who made sure she attended every single game he ever played in the major leagues. I believe if it was at home, but maybe she also took to. I doubt that she attended everyone on the road. That would have been a challenge, especially after children came along.
Right.
But she attended every single home game for 10 years, and so that was the level of her commitment to supporting him, understanding what he was going through, and knowing that he needed support, and she was determined to provide it.
You know, you began your book by taking us to 1962 and the day of Jackie's induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. You focused on a young man named Ron Gabriel who was there that day. Why Ron Gabriel?
I don't know. Maybe it was a mistake.
Oh, I thought it was terrific.
I met Ron Gabriel, and he seemed to me to represent the average fan in a way, except that his devotion to the Dodgers was pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
But that's true of a lot of people back then. And I think that Robinson was fortunate and probably could have done what he did almost only with the Dodger organization, with the Brooklyn background. In that multicultural setting, I think, helped Ricky a lot. He could always count on support at home,
right,
from the Brooklyn folk. And so I took Ron. I interviewed Ron, and I was charmed by his description of going as a nobody to Cooperstown for the induction ceremony,
yes,
and looking, you know, from the peering in to sumptuous dining room, looking at Robinson's.
He described Robinson as looking almost regal, beautiful man,
yes,
at this pinnacle moment in his life.
Yes. Robinson had a presence. I mean, some reporter early on, and maybe it was 1947, said, you can't say like Campanella that he is, he's a product of Italian and African-American. He is the blackest man I ever He is one of the blackest men, or the blackest man I ever saw, and one of the most handsome. And the combination, I think, had a lot to do with his success in a way. He was a specimen. He was really a beautiful-looking man,
mm-hmm,
and a dynamic figure. And he was baseball needed, stars like that. They always do. It always does. And so he succeeded. But it was tough for a while.
How active did Jackie become in the civil rights movement of the late 50s and 60s?
Well, Martin Luther King Jr. could always count on him. If he wanted Robinson's clout, presence, and when people were saying that Robinson had no right to be injecting himself in politics and civil rights, King very eloquently said, no, he absolutely has the right. He has earned the right. Because Robinson, in many ways, was the model for the civil rights protester of the late 40s and 50s.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense of carrying himself into danger with a great deal of dignity. If you remember all those pictures of people, of young men trying to integrate lunch counters and so on. And
they wore jackets and ties sometimes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Robinson, in a way, set the bar for the kind of, the dignified challenge to injustice. To brutal injustice.
You know, he died early, young, at age 53. Why?
Well, it's one of those things. It's just incredible that the year he retires from Major League Baseball, rather than go to the Giants, he just retired altogether. He comes down with diabetes, and he would have been more than one doctor said to me, well, you know, if he had today, he would have been kept alive.
Mm-hmm.
But then they did what they could for him. He got very good treatment, but the disease just became and just took a tremendous toll on his body. So by the end, he was almost blind and had very limited motion. It was extraordinarily pathetic and tragic, and to see his body virtually in his lifetime both glorify him and then betray him in a way. It was sad. But yes, he did die at 52. His widow is still alive, and she was about his age, a little bit younger.
Wow.
She's still alive. And his brother, who was in the Berlin Olympics and came in second to Jesse Owens in the 200,
wow,
he did not do well physically, but he did live into the 80s before dying.
Arnold Rampersad will speak about the life of Jackie Robinson at 7 tonight at the Gem Theater in the 18th and Vine Jazz District. It's all sponsored by Park University. To register, go to park.edu/SpencerCave. Professor, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking the time with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Pleasure's mine.
Tomorrow on the show, she's a city councilwoman and a former attorney. Now she wants to be mayor. We'll ask Alicia Kennedy why her experience makes her a good candidate to become mayor. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.